This is a Faith FM podcast. You're listening to The Faith Experiment with Robbie Bergen, right across Australia, right here on Faith FM.
Hello there, and thanks again for joining once again. I'm Robbie Bergen, and you're listening to The Faith Experiment right here on Faith FM, right across Australia. And on this episode of The Faith Experiment, which is episode number 60, I'm calling this episode George's Journey. Now, why am I calling that? You'll find out very, very soon. But if you are new to The Faith Experiment, this is the show where we talk about faith. We look at the ancient manuscripts of the Old and New Testaments, and we consider what value they have in today's society, and we put them to practice. And if you have been a long-time listener, you would know that you've heard my story of how I went from a non-believer to a believer, and the numerous people I've interviewed who have had similar experiences, but from different backgrounds. Well, on this episode, I am, if you can hear in the background, we are in front of a live venue here at a place called Jindabyne, which is down near Mount Kosciuszko in New South Wales. And it's really cold, but we are excited to be sitting here having a conversation with my new friend, George. Hello, George. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, George, we met briefly yesterday for the very first time. And you and your wife sitting here off the mic a little bit, Robin. And you shared with me just briefly some of the story of your life. And it was fascinating, the little bit that I heard. And we made the arrangement to meet up today and to record this episode, special edition, George's Journey of the Faith Experiment. So thank you for joining me on the show.
Okay, thanks for being here.
So, George, yesterday when we were talking, you shared how that you're from Ballina originally, right? Or currently in Ballina?
Yes, we're in Ballina now.
And
yes.
And where was and what was fascinating is that your wife Robin, you were saying how that you've hit the road. You're traveling around Australia right now.
We are.
So yes. Where have you gone so far?
We've been down to Victoria, and we ventured to Adelaide, and that was for a particular meeting at Christmas time, and then we came back to Canberra because we were coming up here to Jindabyne to come to the camp.
Yeah, right.
Because a friend of ours invited us up here.
So what's your plans after here? Where are you heading next?
Well, we're heading for the Wild West.
Oh, okay.
So
you're going across Nullarbor?
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Have you done it before?
No, we haven't.
Oh, boy.
Whatever we're doing now, we haven't done before.
Oh, okay.
We haven't ventured this far from home.
Now, what fascinated me yesterday in our conversation was you said you won't be home for a few years.
And that's it.
That's the plan, eh?
Yeah, we're intending to go around and smell all the roses.
Wow. That's incredible. Now, George, you shared something interesting yesterday with me, just briefly. You have had, do you mind me telling people how old you are?
No.
You mentioned you're 75,
yes.
Which I found surprising because looking at you, and people can't see you obviously, but looking at you, you don't look 75.
Oh, I probably look like 80, do I?
I was thinking a little bit younger than that. No. And so you mentioned yesterday, just briefly, this is what got my curiosity up to have you on the show, is that you're 75 and for a lot of those years, or many of those years, you were agnostic in that space of not believing, not connected with faith. But recently, like very recently, you've sort of done a 180 a little bit.
I have, yes.
So I am fascinated to hear this story, as I know our listeners will be as well. And so I'd love to spend this episode unpacking your journey, how you were, were you a believer at some point? I think you mentioned yesterday you were.
Yes.
And so obviously at some point you were a believer, then you went in this sort of, I'm going to call it the wilderness, I don't put words in your mouth, but a wilderness sort of journey. And but now something changed in the last, what, a year or something?
Yes.
I think it was. So we're really excited to explore your journey, and it's still a work in progress from what I got from yesterday. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to get straight into your story. But As is my custom on the Faith Experiment, we have a special giveaway at the end of every episode. And on this episode, it's no different. We've got a giveaway, so stick around for the code word that will come in the last few minutes to claim today's great book. It's a little book. It's a fantastic little book. I read this book every single year. It's called Steps to Christ. But right now, we're going to a song.
You're listening to The Faith Experiment with Robbie Bergen, right across Australia, right here on Faith FM. Connect with us via text message on 0488 453 11. That's 0488 453 11. Or send an email to robbie@faithfm.com.au.
When life gets tough and I can't face it, when stormy trials rain on,
This is The Faith Experiment with Robbie Bergen, right across Australia, right here on Faith FM. Listen live or listen later. Get the Faith FM app from your app store today.
Welcome back to The Faith Experiment. This is Robbie Bergen, and this is episode number 60 of The Faith Experiment. I'm calling this episode George's Journey, and sitting in front of me here at Jindabyne, just down the road from Mount Kosciuszko, is, in fact, George. Welcome to the show again, George.
Thank you.
So let's back up a bit then. Where were you born? You're born here in Australia?
No, I was born in the Netherlands. My parents were post-war immigrants, father having served in the British Navy, and he came out here on repatriation.
Oh, okay.
Deal with veterans, etc.
Yep.
I was only 4 years old then.
So you come to Australia... at 4 years of age, where do you move to? Where do your parents move to?
We moved initially to Ocean Grove, which was an immigrant repository place, until you got placement or you could move to other...
So Ocean Grove, for the uninitiated, is where?
Is in Victoria on the coast. It's now a resort area, but back then it was an immigration...
I'm glad I asked the question, because I was thinking Ocean Grove, New South Wales.
No.
Okay, so Victoria, so you landed there. Yeah. And then where did your parents end up settling?
We ended up settling in Geelong.
Okay.
Because father was working for Shell at that time. No, they were building the refinery at Geelong. So
now, to set the context for us, was your family religious at all?
They were.
Yep.
Yes.
So were they Christian?
Yes.
Yep.
Very much so.
And so, growing up, you had like strong Christian education, those sorts of things. Yes.
Yes.
So, what sort of time frame are we talking about for this? What era? What decade?
That'd be in the 60s.
In the 60s?
Yeah.
In the Geelong sort of area?
Yeah.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
One brother.
So would you consider yourself at that point like a devoted follower of Jesus as well?
Oh, yes. Very much so. Yes.
So how do things progress as you go through, you know, the difficult years of teens and young adulthood, those sorts of things? Anything change?
When I went to left school and started working for Commonwealth Bank, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that, but the eventual aim was to go to Avondale.
What were you wanting to study there?
I was hoping to do some missionary work. Yeah.
Here in Australia or the islands?
Well, the objective then was to go to New Guinea, and that was the buzz of the day. But when you read the statistics, it's probably a good thing that I didn't. Missionaries there didn't last too long. It was very dangerous. And so where I was then, I was turning 20, so I had to register for the National Service. And from there, I was called up.
So that's what changed your trajectory from going down the missionary route?
Very much so.
Wow.
And
so describe for us that process of what happened with the registration for the draft and then the draft itself. Like how did it happen? How did you find out? Those sorts of things.
You had to register, which was a card you filled in, and away it went. And then some months later, after they'd done this draw, you got a card in the mail saying you have to attend a doctor's, the government medical officer, and he will assess your progress for national service. Then you went and saw him, and he put you through all the hoops and whatnot and did all these tests, and you didn't hear anything from him. And apart from then, you got another little note in the mail. It was a card. You are to attend the Geelong railway station at da-da-da for transport to Pakapunyal, and you begin your national service on such and such a date.
Wow.
I think it was the 3rd of July at that time.
So here's a question that I don't know if you've been asked this before, and it might be a dumb question, but I know that someone's going to want to ask this question of you. Why did you fill out the form initially when you were told to register? Like, could you just not do it? Like, how would they know? Because it wasn't like those computer systems and interconnected government networks and things. Like, you got a request. You're told to register. Why did you register? Why didn't you not register? Because I know some people in that period were adverse to registering, right?
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Adverse to registering, but they mightn't have had computers, but they did seem to have ways of finding out. And really, when I look back at it, of course, they had your driver's license, so they knew. It was pretty quick to sort of find you.
So it was kind of, there wasn't even a second thought about filling out the form when it arrived.
No, well, we'd heard enough stories about people who hadn't filled out the form and what happened to them.
So there were consequences?
Oh, there were consequences. People would get a knock on the door and they would be arrested. If you didn't register for national service, then you were dragged before the court and asked why you didn't do it, and if there wasn't an acceptable excuse, you were A, you're going in and doing your national service now, or B, if you don't want to do that, you can spend your next 2 years at Holsworthy.
Oh, wow. So as a Christian, though, like you're still a practicing Christian at this point, right? Mm. As a Christian, what was your view on this whole process of being selected for potential frontline service?
My view was we owe a duty to God. We owe a duty to our country. And I was going to do my duty for my country. I was not going to shirk it. And particularly in the small community I was in, a lot of the other people that had been called up, I had been to school with, I had played sport against or with, for me to say, well, I'm not going because of whatever, no. I mean, the randomness of selection sort of denoted, well, you'd better go.
So you obviously passed your medical.
Yes.
And you got the card in the mail to say, show up at the train station.
Yes.
What happens next?
You end up at recruit training, and from there, and I can remember vividly this warrant officer standing there saying, you're all going to Vietnam, get used to it, all of you. You know, I said, how did that work out? And but the Army had its own process of selecting people, and they had, at that stage, worked out what job you were going to do.
Yeah, so it was a foregone conclusion.
It was all laid out. And
so out of curiosity, how far into the campaign in Vietnam was your call up?
We were there in 69-70, in the end of 68, I suppose, about halfway through the campaign, I suppose.
Right.
It all finished.
So there was enough, like, but at that point you would have heard enough stories and seen the photos and the reporting.
Oh,
you
yes.
knew what was happening over there. So
yeah, we did.
To be told you're going to Vietnam, you already knew what you're going into.
Oh, well, you know, we had the option. They said, those of you who want to object, don't want to go to Vietnam, stand over here. And those of you, you know, the rest of you over here. So I said, well, I don't want to particularly go to Vietnam, so I joined the thing, and they said, yeah, well, it's nice of you to be here and to object going, but we need you over there, and you're going. That's it. Get used to it. So,
what was your relationship with faith at that point?
My relationship with God at that point was on a personal level. It was not on a political level or a level of why. Why are we doing this? It had been enough. Carry on. We were supposedly peacekeepers over there, so, you know, the old idiom of blessed are the peacekeepers, and that's what we thought we were going to do. I mean, none of us were gung-ho war heroes. In fact, none of the people that I was serving with were, could you say that they were all Audie Murphy looking for medals type. They went because they'd been called and they were doing their duty, and that was all we did. I remember our commanding officer saying, he said, the real soldiers are you people.
Mm.
He said, I don't want any gung-hos, medal-winning so-and-sos. You people that are hesitant and direct, he said, are more soldier than the rest.
So how long was your training for before they sent you to Vietnam?
We spent 12 months before we went.
So the day comes on a boat, I'm assuming?
No, plane.
Oh, they fly you over?
Modern Army.
Oh, wow.
We planed in.
So you get planed. Where do you end up in Vietnam?
We end up in Nui Dat, is where we finally end up. That was our base. Thuan Son Nhut Air Base is where we landed, or where the Qantas jet landed.
Mm-hmm.
From there, we were airlifted to Nui Dat.
You'd describe for us what was running through your mind.
We were waiting there, and there were soldiers coming off, and we were lining up to sort of go on, and these guys were all saying 365 and as they passed us, and sort of looking, what's the 365? And I said to the guys, I said, they have just told us we've got 365 days left to go
for your tour.
For our tour.
Oh boy.
And they were laughing and giggling. Of course, we suddenly get hit with this, and suddenly we're not laughing and giggling.
Yeah.
This is not funny.
So what's day one like?
Pick up your gear, put it here, put it there. your bed allocations here. You're up on the hill with SAS and D Company. You're their FO, so off you go. That was it.
And the routine begins.
Pick up your radio and pick up this and pick up that, and the routine begins. I remember the intelligence officer coming up. He said, just get your gear in there. He said, you've got an O group briefing in 30 minutes, so we expect you up there.
That fast. Straight into it.
You're into it. So we had to be, there were four of us, of course. Each company had an FO. And
what's FO stand for?
Forward Observer.
Forward Observer.
Yeah, we were artillery people, and our job was to advise the infantry or whoever we were with we actually called the artillery fire in for them. We called in the aircraft fire, air support, and also coordinated searchlight, whatever, and bombing, aerial bombing, wherever we needed. Made sure the Phantoms didn't try to throw their stuff at us.
Like, from your perspective and for the Australians that were there with you, what was your duty there? What were you trying to achieve?
Mostly we were there to upset the supply line that the Vietnamese had set up through the area of South Vietnam. Now, they were trying to supply all their troops with food, ammunition, etc. And they were coming through Cambodia, we knew that, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail, they used to call it. And we were to disrupt that, which we did effectively, plus also maintain peace and order in our own area of responsibility, to make sure that the locals weren't harassed or stood over by, because the North Vietnamese, when they came into villages, weren't very nice.
To their own people, like the South. Yeah.
They butchered, and that's the only word that you can use, a lot of people, unnecessarily and purely as a threat thing. If you don't do what we say, we will be back and the rest of you will get this as well.
So how long were you there in total?
I was there 13 months, a month longer than what should have been, but mainly because my relief, when he came in, there was an incident at Tonsonut when they landed, and he was wounded, so he was sent back, and they had to get another one up from Australia. So we were sort of held back a little till they got these people up.
To take over from you.
From us. Yeah.
So 13 months, Vietnam, foreign country, battleground, front line. What happens in your... like, you obviously saw a lot of stuff that we probably don't need to talk about. But that stuff's got to affect you somehow.
Oh, well, of course it affects you.
Yeah.
I ended up with post-traumatic stress disorder, and there's no worries. I was wounded, and it does have everlasting effect. It does. It takes a long time to get to a livable life, and we're not even talking a normal life, just a livable life.
When you can get through day by day. Yeah.
When you can get through day by day.
So during that time, you went into it as a pretty committed follower of Jesus, as in the time you went to training, you get deployed. What happens to your walk with God and your faith in that 13 months?
It stayed with us. We did, silly things before we'd head out, and we had what we call a queue line where everybody formed up before we moved out. In our tank, it was, we put the little tape recorder in and play how great they were before we went off. And that was a rather disconcerting thing, considering when you hear the clunk clunk of a shell being loaded and banging, and then fire orders, and then me get the turret and pedal to the metal, let's go.
Yeah, must be surreal, because
it was.
In one vein, you're following, you understand about this God, this compassionate God, this loving God, and you're serving Him, and then the other side, you see this horrific behavior of human nature, and you're sort of in the middle of those two things trying to bring some sort of order and peace to it. It must be surreal to live that out.
It is. It is surreal. Yeah. It's even more surreal as regimental medical officer came to me at one stage and said, listen, when the guys are getting wounded, they're bleeding like anything, and the doctors at Vung Tau are saying that you're working them too hard. Their iron levels are right down. They've got to start eating meat, and they've got to start taking these iron pills, you know, sort of build them up. I said, well, how about giving them a bit of a rest? He said, no, not on the cards. He said, that's what's got to happen. The guys around me started laughing. And this officer said, why are they laughing? And then one of the guys on the side, he said, out of all of us, you've picked on the only veggie in the place.
So you were the vegetarian.
I'm the vegetarian. And who's asking me to tell all the other guys to go and eat meat.
Were the other guys vegetarian as well or not?
No.
They just wanted them to eat more, get more iron.
Yeah.
They've asked you to do it.
The only vegetarian in the place.
So how did you go being vegetarian on the front line?
It was difficult. But ration packs were what they were.
Yeah.
We were pretty lucky. We got C rations from the Americans. We got the New Zealand dehydrated packs. But all in all, it was very difficult, but you could manage here and there. I mean, generally, it was well known that I was a vegetarian, so that as they come and open the box and dump it upside down and say, well, that's the veggies. And, he doesn't eat the pork, so that's ours.
Well, this is fascinating, George. I'm really enjoying our conversation. We'll take a short break now. We'll go to a song. And just a reminder to our listeners, we've got a great giveaway coming up at the end of this episode. Stick around for the code word to claim your free copy of the book Steps to Christ. And we'll go to a break. We'll come back, George. We want to pick up what happens after Vietnam.
The Faith Experiment is made possible because of people like you. If you enjoy what we are doing, please consider supporting us by making a donation on our website at faithfm.com.au/donate.
I can feel when my mind starts to creep into doubt. On the days when the strength in my heart's giving out. There's a light, but it hides from me deep in the cloud. There's a voice that I need, but I don't hear a sound. If I run into what I can't see, fighting out of all my unbelief. Father, even in my song will be, I know you will always carry me. It's inevitable. Set your promise to play on repeat in my head. When you meet my anxiety, put it to death. If I run into what I can't see, fighting out of all my unbelief. Father, even in my song, it's inevitable. It's inevitable. It's inevitable.
You're listening to The Faith Experiment with Robbie Bergen, right across Australia, right here on Faith FM.
Welcome back to The Faith Experiment. I'm Robbie Bergen, and this is episode number 60 of The Faith Experiment, which I'm calling George's Journey. And we are recording this live at Genderbine. It's a, what would you call this thing, like a ski resort, I guess, up near the mountains of Mount Kosciuszko. There's no snow here currently. And you know the ironic thing? I was just thinking, George, as we're having this conversation, that it's Anzac Day today as we're recording this. And that must mean something pretty significant to you each year.
It does. It's some people like to say we're glorifying war. And I say to them, there is nothing glorifying about war.
Right.
If it comes to anything, we should do everything we can to avoid it. But unfortunately, our history shows that whether we like it or not, we are going to be involved in wars.
Yeah.
Even down to where the modern dictionary translation of the word peace is that time between wars. There is no talk of there's not going to be a war. There's always going to be a war.
Yeah.
In our history, there's always been a war.
Now, growing up for me, both my grandparents served in various conflicts, mostly in the Korean War. And for me, Anzac Day was always honouring their service and the service of those who lost their lives in it. It wasn't ever for me growing up as a kid going, wow, how great war is. And I think like the younger generation, like you know, we've got like 3 or 4 generations now since even Vietnam, they look at these Anzac Day services and things like this and they see it as, yeah, like you say, like a protest, protesting it against the war idea. But to me, there's a human side to this on both sides. But you know, we remember those that gave their service and lost their lives, and we're grateful that you're able to come back safely. Obviously, you still carry all the scars, mental and emotional scars.
For us, the veterans, it's a memory. We remember those that thing, and it was always the best of us that paid the price. They were all good men, and we remember them. It also brings back a lot of memories for us, and not pleasant ones either. I don't think you would find any veterans that would be advocates of let's have a war. They would be very much of let's think about it and see if we can weasel our way out of it, because really it doesn't matter what war you wage. There are no winners.
I know enough about the Vietnam War to know that when people came back from it, they didn't receive a hero's welcome. In fact, it was pretty much the opposite.
Let's put it all into context. When we were being shipped to Vietnam, we were shipped out at 3 a.m. in the morning. We were quietly transported to the Brisbane airport when the airport was supposed to be closed. And we quietly boarded. Only those relatives that actually lived in Brisbane were aware of what was happening. And we were snuck out of the country to think. The same procedure when we came back. We landed at Sydney Airport at 3 a.m. in the morning. And I can remember very vividly that we were coming off the plane, picking up our gear, and most of us had to wait for other planes in the morning. And I remember this staff person coming up and saying, "You people get out of uniform, and if I see anybody around here in 30 minutes, I'll lock you up."
No ticket day parades.
Or no.
So, what was the sentiment in the public at that time?
Yes, there was opposition to it. There was a political movement was growing that we get out of it. These were not the decisions that the troops on the ground make, and particularly when those troops on the ground were national servicemen. I had to remind a number of people, listen, I didn't go because I had a choice. I went because you sent me. You people elected this government. This government sent us. Now, if you can't abide by what's happened there, then you've got the problem. We just did our duty.
So when you come back, how old are you?
We were 22, all of us.
22. It seems so young, doesn't it, looking back?
It was.
Yeah.
And it was a disruption for most people's careers, whatever they were doing.
So you come back, you're still faithful, come in a relationship with God and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I did. I told you that I had to wait for a relief and
yes.
thing. Well, what happened there was he didn't turn up until the Thursday afternoon. The normal freedom flights, we used to call them.
The flight back home?
The flight back home. They left at 1700 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursdays. Here's this guy turning up at about 1300 in the field and wanting to have big chats with me. And I'm looking at my watch and saying,
"You got 2 hours, buddy."
Yeah, listen, buddy, they're over there, and there's some over there. These guys know what to do. See you later. That chopper you came in on, I'm going out on.
Yep.
That's my freedom flight. Oh, right. I left him there. He was stunned and he was looking at me. He looked at me all the way and I, looking as the helicopter was taking off, he was still looking at me.
Wow.
And I'm sort of pointing at him, you know, sort of get focused on what you've got to be doing.
But you know what's crazy? It's just, like, I'm hearing you tell that and you were 22. I picture 22-year-olds today. I couldn't imagine them with that sort of level of responsibility. Like, half of them haven't figured out what they're doing in their life yet. They're still playing video games.
Yeah.
It's a different mindset, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was. We went there as 20-year-olds, and I can remember our first contact. I was out with Tracker Platoon, and we had this contact, and I'm groveling down in the dirt saying, what's happening here?
Mm.
This is, he doesn't even know me. I mean, the biggest problem I had in my life at that time was how to meet my next car payment. But you suddenly realised if you don't get up and react, you're not going to react.
Yeah. It's a matter of life and death.
It is. These people are out to get you.
So you come back to Australia. Did you go straight back into civilian life?
Straight. I went from Sydney Airport back home, lunchtime, back home. Mum and Dad were there, sort of thing. And I was in, tired, all the rest of it, and hello, I'm back.
What was your reception with your parents like?
Oh, they were happy. I mean, first thing Mother said to me, of course, is tomorrow you're going to church. You haven't been to church for 2 years. I know you haven't.
Wow.
I said, that was pretty profound of you, Mother. How did you work that out? I said, I'm a bit tired, though, and maybe next week. And she said, no, you're going tomorrow. Anyway, Father stepped in and he said, Mother, he has just come straight off the battlefield, and in 24 hours, he's back here. Give him a chance to get his head together. It won't matter. He's going to church tomorrow. We're taking him. Off to church we went. And walking in, I thought, well, the congregation, I knew most of the people there. They'd be sort of, hello, oh, you're back, and that sort of. But I walked into a woman who said, oh, the child killer's back.
Was that in a joking way, or was
no,
that like a straight face?
Very, very serious, the child killer's back.
Referring to your being sent to Vietnam, right?
Yeah. And my father stepped between myself and this woman, which was probably a good thing for her, because of the way my temperament was at that time and reaction. I would have flattened her. And I turned around and said to Mum, I can't do this. I'm out.
So this is literally as you're walking into the church.
Yeah.
Right.
So I turned around, walked out, and never went back again. Now, the pastor never came and saw me. Church elders never came and saw me. There was no backup or, let's have a talk about this and all the rest of it. So I thought, well, must have been the predominant feeling within the congregation. So that's it.
But there were others that would have went too, right, from to Vietnam from your congregation.
No, I was the only one.
You're the only one at the lucky draw.
The only one.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
So okay.
There were other guys from other areas that I'd been, like I said, been to school with, but no, I was the only one from our congregation.
Oh wow.
And the only one that ever got called up. So
when you get back home, how's your relationship with your mother, your father, all about what just happened? What did they say?
Mother was very upset. Father was sort of saying to him, well, you know, you really should have given him a chance to settle so that he could have handled this. You knew what the feeling of the congregation was. And she said, yes, but I thought once they saw him that they wouldn't say it because they've known him since he's knee-high to a grasshopper. And
yeah.
That soured me. I thought, you've just destroyed my home base. You've just destroyed where I thought my foundations were, and you've destroyed them. I need to move on from here. And I did move on. I never went back. I did move to other churches for a period of time, but never ever settled in any of them.
So over a period of, I'm assuming, years, what happens next in terms of, like, for me, in my own journey, there's a relationship with a congregation that share the same, at least the same tenets of faith, but then there's the individual, like my personal walk with God. So obviously you had a sever with the congregation or the community, but what happened with you and your relationship with God?
I still maintained a relationship with God, but there was that fracturing. I was never going back to that church. Along with that, PTSD kicked in. There's a number of ways that the veterans deal with PTSD. One is booze.
Yep.
The other one is work. And I followed the pattern of work. And
workaholics. Keep yourself distracted.
Keep yourself distracted and keep yourself, you know, moving. And that was the pathway I went. Of course, that in itself does not adhere you to your home life, because why would it?
Yeah.
You're never there.
Yeah.
You're always at work.
What were you doing for work?
Well, I initially jumped from job to job to job, but I eventually settled in the ambulance service, and I stayed there for 27 years.
Wow. So you would have seen some stuff in that career as well.
Yes, I did, actually. And some of it was worse than Vietnam, believe it or not. Some of the things that people do to each other and road accidents, etc.
How would you describe your view of the world at this point? Are you still a believer? Are you? I know I heard the term yesterday, agnostic. Like,
yeah, I was still a believer in God.
Okay.
But that's as far as it went. I did not, yeah, I wouldn't go and follow any particular religion or thing. I just straight off the rails, I suppose you'd say.
So how long do you live like this?
For 53 years.
53 years.
Yeah.
So life just played out year after year, decade after decade.
Yeah, ramble, yeah.
Did you end up getting married?
Yes.
I'm guessing that there were challenges with the work life. And the
there were lots of challenges with the work life, and unfortunately, the marriage ended, and also the how do you live with a workaholic
who's never around?
Who's never around? Mm. Exactly.
Did you have kids?
One daughter.
And that would impact that relationship too, I'm guessing.
That was a pretty firm relationship, actually. It's surprisingly in amongst all that. One that blossomed really well.
So yes. Bring us up to speed then. What's happened in the last year or so? What was the change that's got us sitting here having a conversation about your life?
Big change has been that I met my wife in that time, very late in life. Yeah.
Smiling.
That in itself is another sort of a story. The short version was we met online.
Really?
Yes. And I was in Cairns. I was going around Australia, the top end way, and then sitting in Cairns, and then all of a sudden the rain started, and then it rained.
And when it starts in Cairns raining, it doesn't stop for a while.
It doesn't stop for a while. And I kept asking the locals, when does the rain stop? Because I want to go around the top. Oh, another couple of weeks and you'll be right. I sat there for 6 weeks.
That sounds like Cairns.
And it didn't even look like stopping. And in the meantime, I met a myriad of people telling me about not a good idea to go around the top here, not a good idea, there's too many crocs, and go and see so-and-so and make sure if you're going to go around, you get yourself a firearm and all this sort of stuff. I said, I'm an ex-vet. I want nothing to do with firearms. Well, you better get something to protect yourself because the crocs are wild. And this guy was really, really adamant. You would be silly to continue if you didn't have something to deal with crocs. I said, oh, well, maybe then that's not a good idea for me to go there, mate. Anyway, it rained some more. And in the end, I said, everything's getting flooded. The roads are getting flooded and whatnot. And if I stay here any longer, I'm going to be stuck here because you can't even get out of the place. So I started heading south. Now, I normally head south inland, the inland route. That was flooded, so I had to do the coastal route. And I went down the coast, and the rain was following me all the way and ended up in Ballina, of all places. And sort of looking around, and thought, well, better late in the afternoon, better find somewhere to stop. And there was this caravan park just on the outskirts of Ballina. I thought, this is... And a little voice said, no, not this one. Anyway, and there's another one in town. And the little voice said, once again said, no, not this one. And I'm thinking to myself, apart from being 75 years old, now you're listening to little voices telling you, don't stop here, don't stop there. Keep going. You don't know this place. Where are you going? Anyway, I continue up the road, and then it says, turn off here. And there's this turn off that went down this hill, and I'm sort of looking. I normally don't go down those sorts of roads. It's a bit... Anyway, I took the turn and down, and a kilometre up the road, there was another right-hand turn, and there's this caravan park. And I pulled in there, and it was a beautiful place right beside this lake and dry, and it was great. And then the person there on the counter said, how did you find this place? I said, I don't know. A little voice told me to come here. I said, I went past two perfectly good caravan parks, and I ended up at this one. She says, oh, not many people who are travelling through find this place. It's a little bit out of the way. I'll say it's out of the way, but it's nice here. So I stayed there, and I met Robin and invited her out for a coffee at the local restaurant and whatnot. And she didn't tell me where she lived or whatever. And well, to cut a long story short, it was some time later that I found out that the caravan park and where Robin lived were very close together.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then it sort of hit me that this is not coincidence. This, you don't do this and this.
So you meet Robin for the first time?
Yeah, and then it sort of worked.
So I'm assuming, looking at Robin now, I'm assuming that you are a woman of faith. So, did you know that when you were talking online?
I did.
But you still met up anyway.
Yeah.
Wow. So, what's the journey of faith look like since you met?
Very good. The first time we both went to church together, I walked into the church at Ballina, and it felt like I was coming home.
Really?
Really.
Now, this has been, what, 50-something years?
Yeah, and wow. People welcomed me, and I actually got the welcome that I suppose I was looking for when I came back from Vietnam.
Wow.
Those people gave me that. And it was, you know, as I described it, like putting on an old pair of slippers.
Yeah.
And just fitted straight in and never looked back since.
So what happened after you attended the first time? Did you, like, rekindle your personal relationship with God?
I did, yes.
How did that happen?
Robin organised for me to speak to the pastor, Tim, and it moved on from there. I spoke with him, told him my story and all the rest of it, and I thought, well, this will be the last time I see him. He's gone. But no, he was back. and he kept coming back every week.
Yes.
And I got baptised, or re-baptised, because I'd already been baptised, and re-baptised. And, yeah, like I say, I never looked back.
So looking back on your journey, what would you say to your 22-year-old self on that day that lady made that comment to you that caused you to leave? Would you go back and say, give yourself any advice now that you've been through this time of 50-something years, you've rediscovered your relationship with God? What advice would you give if you could go back to your 22-year-old self?
I'd probably say to myself, find another church. This church is against you. There's no two ways about that. I stormed out and said, I'm never, ever going back in here. That was the greatest mistake.
So you regret that looking back?
I regret that.
Yeah, because, I mean, one person's comment, reflective of a congregation probably.
Yeah.
But, yeah, to have that impact you for the next 50-something years. Like, that's
yes.
A...
And I should have also realised that the group of women there were other members of the congregation that were good people, and they still are good people.
Yeah.
Very good people, actually.
I've been to a lot of different denominations in my journey to faith.
High.
Yeah, and you know what I've learned? I've learned that there's not a single congregation on earth that's heaven yet.
No.
And... yeah, it's very easy to, and I've heard people tell stories. I've got family that have had the stories where they've gone into churches and something's been said the wrong way, someone's done the wrong thing or didn't do something. Like, I know people who've gone to church and they weren't welcomed. And so they took that as like, well, that's my sign, I'm not coming back. And I like to say this, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, but we can't allow our walk with God to be impacted by those around us professing one way or the other. Yeah. You know? What's your take on that now?
That is probably a true statement, but I'm from a human point of view, of course.
Yeah.
We're all pretty gregarious and we all want to feel accepted.
Yes.
And back in those days, you knew the whole thing that I had been part of was a touchy area with a lot of people.
With Vietnam you're talking about?
Yeah. What I wasn't expecting that it was a touchy thing within my congregation.
Yeah, for the closest people that grew up with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
So have you... Like, did you hold resentment, like anger, hatred to these sorts of people and these comments? And
No. I did at first, but I let that go years ago.
Yeah.
I had too many other problems to overcome.
Yeah.
And move forward.
So for our listeners out there that might have a similar story to yours, you know, being through difficult experiences with maybe their family, maybe their local congregation, what advice would you give them with all your experience now? Like, what would you say to them if they're currently where you were, you know, at age 22, 23, what would you say to them? What advice would you give?
I'd say take a deep breath and rethink it. And rethink it when you're calm. And talk to people. And that is most important. You can destroy yourself for absolutely no reason at all.
Well, George, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. We promised to give away a book. So if you take out your phone now, for our listeners, and text the code word hash FE60. That's hash, the hash symbol, FE for faith experiment, 60 for episode 60. So hash FE60. Text that to the number 0488 453 11. That's 0488 453 11. And the SMS bot will ask you for some details, and we will get to you this great gift, Steps to Christ. It's a little book, very easy to read, and it will lead you from wherever you are back into a living, breathing relationship with Jesus. So claim that offer today. George, any final thoughts to share with our listeners before we end the episode?
Oh, the final thought is there's always hope.
Oh, I love it.
There's always hope. And I believe God will look after you.
So just hang in there.
just hanging there.
Well, thank you again, George, for making the time to put this into a recording. And, it's been a privilege to hear your story. Thank you for what you've done for this country. Despite, the differences of politics and those sorts of things, it's still real people that have had to do a real job. And I'm just grateful you were able to come back safe. And it sounds like the later years are going to be more rewarding than the earlier years. So blessings to you and to your new wife.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to The Faith Experiment with Robbie Bergen, right across Australia, right here on Faith FM. Connect with us via text message on 0488 453 11. That's 0488 453 11. Or send an email to robbie@faithfm.com.au and let us know what you thought of this episode.
Hello there, this is Robbie. It's a bonus. Just letting you know that I am on the road again in 2024, and I am going to be taking the Faith Experiment to various towns, capital cities, and regional centres right around this great country of ours. To stay up to date, subscribe to our Facebook page and check out faithfm.com.au/events. And let's see if we can meet up in your town.